Welcome back to the CTO Playbook, the podcast dedicated to helping CTOs excel. In this episode, I'm talking to Dan Gualter about the formula for becoming a successful fractional CTO. Dan shares his journey from corporate burnout to building a thriving consulting business and breaks down the key steps to making it work. We get into why niching down doesn't actually limit your opportunities, but rather expands them, why the surest sales strategy isn't selling at all, and how talking to people without an agenda can be the surest way to build a pipeline of clients. Plus, Dan reveals the most crucial mistake most consultants make with their LinkedIn profiles that could be costing them clients. If you're thinking about making the leap into fractional consulting or just want to sharpen your approach, listen on as Dan breaks it down into a tried and trusted playbook. I'm Adam Horner, your host. As a coach for CTOs, from startups to enterprises, from fractional to full-time, I empower tech leaders to escape the cycle of lurching from crisis to crisis and build the skills to lead with confidence, clarity, and purpose. I offer hands-on, personalized coaching designed to tackle the unique challenges within your organization, helping CTOs transition from reactive firefighting to proactive strategic leadership. My goal is to empower each CTO to carve out their own growth path, enabling them to delegate with confidence, align engineering with business goals, and fully embrace their role as a trusted, influential member of the executive team. This podcast is my way of bringing powerful playbooks to you and the many CTOs looking to expand their expertise. Through conversations with incredible guests, we unpack the most pressing topics for executive tech leaders, sharing insights, strategies, and practical advice to help you build and refine your own playbook so you too can excel as a CTO. Dan, it's fabulous to have you on the podcast. Really good of you to join you. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Adam. It's great to see you. You're looking really well. I take it that life has been treating you kindly.
Life is getting better, that's for sure. Yeah, I've got the branded cap now, so feeling great about running the podcast this evening. Cool. I would really love to introduce you to the listeners because you've got this amazing background as to how you got to fractional leadership. So if you just tell us a little bit about your background and how you got to the point of being a fractional consultant.
Yeah, sure. I'm going to try and condense this because, you know, the gray hair suggests I'm not as young as I used to be. But I was that tech guy that grew up in technology and aspired to be an IT leader, and I achieved it. I achieved the dream, became an IT director very young, took an organization through some rounds of private equity and into an IPO. And then what should have been the happiest time, I realized I was absolutely miserable because I chased all of the wrong things. And I'd created this life for myself that wasn't 9 to 5. It was relentless. It was everything. There was nothing around the outside. And so I became totally disenfranchised with corporate life. I decided I didn't want to ever do that ever again. And I hit reset in every sense of the word. And I guess at that point, all I knew was that I wanted to take the things that I was really good at, that I enjoyed, and monetize that. That was like my simple capitalist brain was, wouldn't it be really cool if you could build a business where you only did the things that you enjoy doing with people that you like?
Right.
And I mean, this would have been 2010, 2011. We were still allowed to call ourselves consultants back then. And so it wasn't a swear word. And so that's exactly what I did. I went out and I got lucky. I got a few referrals. I landed on my feet and life was grand. But, you know, there's always a sting in that tail, right? It's not as easy as pitching up with a job title and getting some referral business and monetizing that on a sort of time and materials basis. I learned it the hard way around. And I'm sure you've seen similar in your walk of life as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think I started out on the fractional approach 2.5 years ago, and yeah, a slightly smaller timescale than yours, but the first year was great because I had all the contacts, I had the referrals, I was able to start off with my existing contact book, and then the contact book ran out and the change in the pace of cost of money happened. And so, yeah, I had to relearn a lot of those things that you've picked up. But let's have a look at the early stages. You said you were chasing the wrong things in that first sort of role you had that was, successful in inverted quotes.
So I was city of London, you know, born and bred, in and out of Liverpool Street every day, long hour and a half commute either side. But that's how I was brought up. I was brought up to believe that's what we did, is we climb this corporate ladder and we get to the very top and we've achieved fame and fortune and everything gets easy. But it wasn't me. I'd created this weird mask of corporate Dan. You know, I've got tattoos on my arm, so I always wore long sleeves. I always carried my jacket with me. I was that guy. And it just sapped the life out of me on a daily basis to the point that I wasn't really enjoying what I was doing. I was good at it. I had a great team. I'd created an amazing team from an IT function perspective. I had a board that genuinely loved what I was doing. But I'd leave and I'd be like, there's got to be more to life than just doing this day in, day out. You know, this.
So the bits you chased were the title, the pay, the position, the company, the prestige.
I remember we moved into Heron Tower, which is now Salesforce Tower. And I remember the day we moved in there thinking, my God, you have landed. So you're like IT director inside Heron Tower, team of 150 people. You've got it. You've got power. You've got money. You've got kudos. You've got credibility. But it, as years went by, it just became meaningless to me. I just got to a point where I was like, I can be good almost on autopilot. It wasn't challenging me in any way, shape or form. And then when the organization IPO'd, we went from being this crazy, wide-eyed, sort of excitable startup financial services organization with huge growth plans. We achieved it by done. We went from, you know, 10 times multiplier over the course of 7 or 8 years. And I genuinely looked at them when all that's ahead of me now is slow and steady. We're a listed company, shareholders are involved, everything's about shareholder confidence and reputation. And we're starting to wrap ourselves up in this crazy red tape that is only there for bureaucratic purposes. You can't make like a quick decision anymore. And I was losing staff because they were like, we used to be able to do you remember like we used to get into a room and just make decisions and make stuff happen? Like, yes, why can't we do that? Because I've got to get board approval. And my board, the scariest bit, I said I had a very supportive board. I had one of the best executive teams. The CEO was a visionary. The COO who I reported through was an absolutely amazing lady. But they were frustrated.
Right. The whole team. It wasn't just you. It wasn't sort of just
right up the very, very top. And it blew my brain. I went out for lunch with the CEO and he was like, this is kind of what we built. You know, when we were little, we were trying to get big. We now got big. Now we've got to live this and we've all got lock-ins. You know, we've all got golden handcuffs for at least 6 months. You've got to sit this out and behave and be corporate and don't mess it up. Don't drop the ball. I did 6 months and one day. And I went into the CEO's office and I was like, you know, the whole sit still for 6 months. I think now is the time I need to go and do something with my life that I can look back on and be like super proud of, not just the achievement, but I remember saying to him, I want a life that is not life versus work. You know, I had years where I cancelled holidays, sold back holidays, where I didn't do weekends because I was working. I was doing like late to do over the weekend deployments of technology. And I missed my kids growing up at that point. I had no relationship at home. I had no passions. You know, if you said to me today, what's your passion? I'd say riding horses, playing the guitar, looking after my kids, taking my wife out for dinner. I had none of that. I remember walking my worst moment. I walked out of a restaurant on Valentine's evening because the CEO of the organization was trying to do an equity deal. And of all the things, the fax machine had failed. He was like, I wouldn't phone, but you're an equity partner. You know, when I said you sell your soul when you take equity, this is one of those moments. I need a fax machine to get a contract document over to the private equity company so they can sign it off to secure 250 million. And so I ditched a restaurant. I made my apologies. I drove across country with a fax machine in the boot of my car and delivered it to his house.
Wow.
Different life. Different life.
Yeah. So after 6 months and a day, you didn't look back at that one then. What was your immediate next steps after that day?
Blind panic. It wasn't thought through. I had this crazy dream about what I wanted. I had no concept as to how I was going to execute it. I'd seen other people doing it, like day rate contractors, and I thought that's what we did. So I started talking to agencies that I'd used on the other side, I'd used as recruitment partners. A bit like you, I had my little black book, and I phoned around, and quite quickly I'd found engagements, but they were like single line, you're going to work with this company for 6 months at this rate. And that then flowed into a new problem. The new problem was the gaps were inconsistent. Sometimes it was 6 months and sometimes it was a year. But then the gap was sometimes it was a day, sometimes it was 4 months. It was totally unpredictable. It was so dependent on what either a recruiter or a referral partner or a friend could bring to me. And it was about then I went out to lunch with a, called in a favor from a sales guy that I knew. And I was like, how do we get out of this, what I then called feast and famine?
Right.
It's like, the problem with your business, Dan, with all due respect to you as a human, is it's entirely predicated on inbound referrals. And if you continue to do that, your life will be blind panic for various points in the process. And if you took it, his advice, he was like, if you look at it over your career, you'd probably be better off going as a perm member of staff and taking the steady, stable salary. And so I took that part a lot.
But you didn't take the approach of going to get the stable salary then. You took the hard
one. There was an interesting thing that was happening around 2012, 2013. I remember talking to a recruiter for one of the big boards, and he said to me, the strangest thing, our surveys had just come back in. Have a guess at the average tenure for different types of roles. So employed versus contract versus interim. And I guessed, and I went, employed 10 years, contract 2 years, interim 6 months. And he was like, in 2005, yes. But in 2013, the employed, the average tenure is 5 years and dropping. And I was like, well, if you've got like financial responsibility, because the gap between employed roles is far longer.
Yeah.
If you've got a financial responsibility, having a job that's supposedly for life that lasts 5 years, it's terrifying. It creates that environment where you hop a lot. And so I went back to the drawing board. I decided to create a model that said, it doesn't matter how busy I am, a percentage of my time is dedicated to perpetuating my future pipeline, business development, as we would call it now.
Yeah.
And I started designing that and building it so that I could do it on repeat. I started to embrace that horrible topic of networking. You know, I was that guy, you know, networking events, I hid in the toilets. I was horrible. I hated it. The thought of walking up to a random stranger and making small talk, pretending to be interested for the sake of creating a connection, I hated. What I learned was actually, it's not about making small talk. It's about actually genuinely being interested in people. And most networking, good quality networking, it's not selling. It's
curiosity.
Just curiosity. Go and ask stupid, go and ask dumb questions. And if you are able to help, do that. Help them. No agenda, free of charge. Here's the answer. And I built a model that was based on me wandering around, you know, on LinkedIn, off LinkedIn, in-person events, wherever I could do it, just asking dumb questions and giving people advice. And some of that became future clients.
Right.
But what also happened is some of that became people saying, hey, if this is the topic you're thinking of, you want to go and speak to Dan because it's right in his wheelhouse. You know, that's his area of speciality. And so I started to recognize that actually, if you do it consistently, you create that brand, you create that reputation, and you get credibility for it. And so people come and talk to you.
Yeah, it's reputation and credibility that build over time. And I love that point you made about a job for life, because it was very clear in my family. My grandfather had a job for life. One employer. He was employed by Shell, and he was literally employed there for pretty much his entire working career, with a short gap when there was a war and when he was involved in that. But yeah, Shell employed him for his entire life. My father had a career for life, but I think there's a lot of people now who, you know, a career can last 5 years and jobs even shorter than that. And so I think that, you know, in terms of the evolution of the way that work is going, it's, for me personally, my family, it was made very clear by that progression. I'm sure you've seen something, you know, incredibly similar in people around you, in what work means itself has changed so much. And what you're known for is now becoming as important as what you do.
Totally. So look, around 2014, I ditched a job title. And I remember having conversations with people going, what are you? And I go, I'm a consultant. Yeah, but what? And I'd explain the one little sliver of thing that I was really bloody good at. And so I remember saying to people, I work with financial services companies when they hit their scale up journey and they realize that things aren't going as quickly or as smoothly as they seem, as they should. That's me. And I built a reputation on that. I built a reputation on being able to talk to executive teams about why that happens without flipping into sort of technical jargon and saying, you know, it's technical debt, scary, scary, and talking them through it. And over time, that became my thing. That's where people would come to me and they'd be saying, you know, I was speaking to so-and-so and he said that you do a lot of work with regards to scale-ups and making scale-up work. And we just filled it. I remember a founder coming to me and saying, it used to be so much easier when we were small. And now it's also complicated and it's also slow and my engineering team's flat out busy and I don't even know what they're doing. And every time I ask the lead of engineering what the answer is, he says, we need 3 more heads. And I'd get into these really weird conversations, like where I wouldn't have to talk about technology. I say, so what happens is you started off over here and you got to here and you grew really quick. Some of those decisions were just rubbish. Okay. They got you there, but they weren't the right decisions. And now you're carrying all of that weight along with you and everybody's running around just to lift the weight and move it forward. It's kind of
simple analogies.
Very, very simple. Very like totally and something that anybody can understand. Something I could explain to my 5-year-old. I go, do you want to carry that bag or would you like me to put it down and we'll walk without it? And that kind of led into, so how do we do that? And then sort of describing a process, like a discovery process that would show them where the badness was in their ecosystem, be it people, data, technology, processes, and then proposing a plan to move away from it. That became my thing. And I looked at it and went, is that CTOing? Is it IT directing? Is it technology leadership? Where it's aspects of it. And that's to your point regarding the world of work changing is there are so many people out there right now making a really good living just doing one aspect of the totality of the role,
yeah,
doing it really bloody well. And if there's one argument I get into with fractional folk, more often than not, they say, oh, I'm a fractional CMO. Okay. Nobody buys a fractional CMO. They buy a part-time CMO, maybe, or they do a contract CMO, possibly. If they're looking for a fractional, what they're actually saying is, we have a problem and we're looking for somebody that can fix that. I don't care about the gazillion other great experiences and skills that you've got. Can you do that and can you prove it? That's fractional. And it,
yeah,
when you get that right, it's such a cool feeling. When people start talking to you about things that you actually love and are passionate about, and it lights you up. When you get out of bed in the morning, you go, I've got 5 conversations in the diary today, and they're all going to be that sort of conversation. And it's something that I really enjoy. And I don't have to think about people management, performance appraisals. Well, I praise myself quite regularly, and it's never a pretty experience, but you get to pick the bit that you enjoy, yeah, and focus on the outcome that you create, and then everybody's happy. So, you know, it's a different way of thinking about life.
And the other bit that I find about it that's kind of not intuitive as well is just because you're known for doing that one thing doesn't mean to say that you only end up doing that one thing, because people say, oh, you can do that. Hey, I wonder if you can do this other thing as well. And, you know, half the time it's close enough related, you can go, yeah. So I found quite a number of conversations have started off from, oh, you do that thing really well, but can you do this thing? If the answer is yeah, then you end up doing that thing and you do it just as well and with just as much fun, but you're still focused on one specific thing you're doing. It's the outcome focus, isn't it? I mean, I think that's one of the key things that I've discovered, and I think that's one of the key things that you put forward as well, right?
Yeah, I think, so look, there's a lot of noise, there's a lot of bluster about ICP and niche. You know, who's your ideal customer and what niche do you sit in? And what I would say to anybody listening to this is, that's a marketing thing, okay? Yes, I have one, and yes, I've created hundreds, but it's not actually a limiting factor. No. People fear that if you zone into like a nucleus of a thing that you do, that you'll turn your back on an entire addressable audience. And the simple truth is, it just makes you more visible to the people that are relevant when you start having your conversations with them, because you're coming from a position of expertise. You can share with them your additional. So, you know, I did 3 or 4 years as a ISO 27001 implementer. I've taken that into organizations when I was actually there to deal with, you know, technology leadership. And I go, actually, I think the real problem here is that you've got a real information security culture issue. Let's address that while we're here. Yeah. Or digital transformations, you know, most of the projects I've had to work on to deliver an outcome have been top projects. So I've had to be good at
everything that goes into mobilizing a project, managing it day to day, understanding stakeholder demographics, delivering outcomes. So I don't think your niche should limit you. It's a marketing technique to position you.
Yeah. And I think when people have that, when they understand that, then it becomes, I mean, to be honest, it's very similar to how an employee in a very large organization is as well. You're there to do one specific job in a specific team, in a particular department in the grand hierarchy of this massive organization. You do one thing that you're sort of there with your job title to do. But in order to make that happen, you need to do a bunch of other things, work with other teams, collaborate with other different things. It isn't actually that different, except for the fact that you're being paid specifically as a consultant to go in and fix that one thing. And you have to sort out a bunch of other things in order to make that happen as well. Like ISO 27001 compliance, for example, putting processes in place. Yeah.
I think you're absolutely spot on. I am a firm believer that competent people will always find activities to engage themselves. I don't know how it happens. I don't know how the universe works. I'm not going to pretend to be a religious man. But I do believe that if you've got aptitude and enthusiasm and you are relatively fearless, you're going to find yourself in a whole ton of weird and wonderful situations, some of which you love, some of which you might not like. And so when I work with people, I say to them, don't close doors for the sake of closing doors. Okay. Go through the door, make an educated decision as to whether it's somewhere you want to be. If there are some red flags that you don't like, then step back gracefully and retreat. But if those red flags aren't there, then why wouldn't you head in that direction? That could be, and I think it's something that I see people do all the time. There's nothing wrong with pivoting. And so certainly I found I did 2 or 3 years doing scale-up consultancy and that type of stuff. I then pivoted because a lot of my clients were saying, hey, Dan, we're in our scale-up. Our CTO isn't really a CTO. They're sort of like an engineer that woke up with a job title. And, you know, we'll call him Bob for sake of better names. Bob's been with us since day one, and he's a great engineer. He's got no credibility at executive level. Now we've got these investors in. They're not happy. And so I don't know what to do. What do I do? And I said, well, I can coach Bob to be more executive and more strategic and more commercial, or I can help Bob understand that he probably doesn't want the CTO job title because it is executive, strategic, and commercial, and I can help you find a real one. And so I pivoted over the course of 6 months. I found that more and more of my engagements were running into the back of this problem. And so I was like, actually, you're pretty good at that. Let's take that on. And so that was my next directional travel. And I was like, 3 or 4 years of doing that, because it was a new opportunity that I hadn't shied away from. It's all out there.
Yeah, that's so funny, because I've had exactly the same thing over the last few months, helping people with putting in place a recruitment process and interview steps to help find senior tech leadership. It's an incredible paralleler. And talking about finding things, I mean, let's talk about how people actually become seen, because you've talked about, you know, knowing what it is that you do, speaking to a lot of people and starting those conversations. How do people get into those conversations? How do they sort of get to the point where those conversations are started by somebody else?
I do look at this very, very mechanically and methodically these days. There's a starting point, which is your ICP, knowing who it is you are best talking to and understanding how they would describe the symptoms of their problem in their language is a super powerful foundation to have in place. If you don't have it, you are going to come unstuck somewhere. But once you've got that, the next thing that I see people make a mess of is their LinkedIn profile looks like an employee's LinkedIn profile. So they're trying to position themselves out here as like this freelance consultant and, you know, consultant, advisor, fractional, as a service, on demand, whichever your preferred parlance. They're saying that, and you look at their LinkedIn profile and it looks like a CV, and it sends out weird mixed messages. So when you try and start conversations with people, their barriers are naturally higher because they go, sounds like a freelancer, looks like an employee, not even going to take the risk that this is a job pitch.
So what are the top things that when you look at somebody's LinkedIn profile, you go, okay, that's an employee type profile or that's a consultant type profile?
So I divide LinkedIn profiles into two, into above the fold and below the fold. So anywhere right. Where you don't have to scroll is above the fold. The purpose of that part of the LinkedIn profile is to catch someone's attention and educate them that you are the right person for them. So first things first, if they got to your profile, then your headline probably did your job. And if your headline is, you know, just a collection of job titles separated by pipes, the chances are nobody's visiting your profile.
If you go to your profile analytics and you're getting sub 50 profile views a week, your profile, your headline is not doing its job. It should be pushing people. By talking about that problem that you solve for your ideal customer and creating a level of intrigue that goes, oh, he's quite an interesting chap. Jump. If they land on your profile, what do I look at? The banner. The banner is comedy gold. If the banner is the two-tone gray that LinkedIn ships with by default, if the banner is a holiday photo, a wedding photo I saw the other day, it's not serving a purpose.
Yeah.
And for me, I kind of look at it and go old school. How much would you pay to have a 100-foot wide billboard in central London advertising your services? Yet LinkedIn provides that free of charge for you to a billion potential audience members. And you're not optimizing it. So billboard, banner, headline. The biggest giveaway, though, is when you go slightly below the fold and you look at the about section. And I think, I just don't think people are aware of how people perceive it. Most people's about sections read like this. Hi, I'm Dan. And, you know, with a 25-year experience in technology leadership, I've had the pleasure of working with X, Y, and Z and doing A, B, and C and, you know, growing teams from here to here and blah, 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 blah. It's all very narcissistic and self-fulfilling.
Yeah.
The problem with that is that particular section on LinkedIn is a foldable section. Three lines, see more. If those first three lines are all about you, I'm not going to click see more. I've given up caring at this point. I look at it and go, employee, move on. And so when I work with people and I help them shape that, I say, think about it from them. Think about good writing formula. So pain, agitate, solve. First three lines have to grab hold of your ideal customer and almost punch them. You know, with the pain that they've got. A classic example, there's a lady, I won't name her on the podcast because her profile views go through the roof and she blames me for it. But she's an HR advisor for scale-up organizations. And she says, her about section, the first three lines are like, used to be a lot easier when you were smaller, right? Finding the right talent and retaining the right talent seemed like it was effortless. But as you've started to grow, things have slowed down. That's the beginning of her about section. And I look at that and go, genius. I just want to see what you say next. And so you click see more and she agitates it. She says, if you don't do anything about this, carry on this cadence, then teams are going to become disenfranchised. Your talent quality is going to drop. Your output's going to become unmeasurable. And then she flows into that segue, into that sort of resolve, a solution.
Yeah.
Over the last 25 years, I've helped organizations just like you with these problems by doing this. And I go, perfect. There you go. My ideal customer lands. They see something that is super painful. They read, they see a solution. There's a call to action. Job done. And that's how I differentiate really quickly whether you are CV fodder for a recruiter or whether you're consultant material looking for clients.
Hey, everyone. Quick question for you. Have you ever thought about starting a video podcast like this one? I want to introduce you to the team behind my show, Podigy. This podcast has been one of the best marketing tools for my business. And thanks to Podigy, all I have to do is record. They handle everything else. Editing, publishing, and making sure it's optimized perfectly for every platform. They're usually fully booked, but right now, they have a few spots open for new clients. As listeners of this show, you get 10% off launching your own podcast or optimizing your current one. All you need to do is follow the link in the description to book a free one-to-one podcast planning session with Podigy. Can you understand the pain and describe it in their terms rather than expressing what you've done in your terms?
Such a huge point. One of the fundamental mistakes that I see certainly technical folk make, less so with the CFOs and CMOs and that type of roles, but certainly CTOs, CPOs. These guys and this audience, they're smart. They're technically very, very intelligent. But where they lack is their ability to actually translate that language into a language that is relevant to their ideal customer. So if I go back to the technical debt side of things, kind of gone to market going, hey, I'm the guy that solves technical debt for financial services companies. I guarantee you most CEOs would scroll straight past because they wouldn't believe that they've got a technical debt problem.
Yeah.
So you're just the only people. And if you think about like LinkedIn content, if you look at a lot of people's LinkedIn content and you look at who's engaging, it's just their peer group. A great post, really understand. This really resonates with me, blah, blah, blah. And I go, it is a good post if you were trying to talk to people just like you. But unfortunately, if you want to talk to CEOs, founders, CFOs, investors, VCs, you have to talk in a language that actually means something to them that highlights that you actually do understand.
And this is what I find when I'm coaching CTOs, is that CTOs have often come to their position by going through a relatively insular path. And I mean that insular from the point of view of not being exposed to sales techniques, to storytelling techniques, and from the power of empathy in communication, just because they don't have the role models or the experiences of going through that. Whereas somebody who comes to the C-suite through the marketing side, from the sales side, from the operations side, it's kind of a fundamental requirement to get there, is you can do this and actually express pain points in somebody else's perspective, and then bonus points if you can say how you solve it. But us engineers tend to communicate rather frankly and logically, and unfortunately most people don't speak logic.
No, logic is, you know, common wisdom is remarkably uncommon. there's a funny experiment I do with people where I say, tell me a story. Imagine you're writing a piece of content for LinkedIn or a newsletter or an email or even in a proposal. Tell me a story. And they say, well, there was this one time that I was doing this thing. And they immediately fall into that. I was and I did. And I go, okay. You know, the real clever thing with the most powerful stories, if you go out and you read them, you look at some of the best content creators, some of the best news and email writers, they manage to tell you a story that makes the reader the hero of the story. If you can learn that skill, oh my God, not only is it a great skill to have in your arsenal, but you'll find that you do it in everyday life. And it's scary, contagious. My wife says to me now from time to time, she's like, just give me the answer. Don't tell me the story. I don't care if I'm the hero of your story, just give me the bloody answer, Dan. So it can go on out of control, but knowing how to captivate somebody with a story that's clearly about them, that promotes where they could be, is how the most successful, if I take CTOs, the most successful CTOs, when they work with executive teams, can take the deep-rooted fear or worry or concern of an entire executive team and most them's the hero of the situation in their story.
Yeah.
And suddenly their recommendations receive no friction. They, you know, no objections. Yes, let's do that. That sounds like an amazing outcome to us collectively. Life's a lot easier.
Yeah. And it comes from that simple, straightforward, I say simple and straightforward, the selling perspective. Whether you're selling a project or whether you're selling a service for finance, you know, for real dollars, I think it's that exposure that most tech leaders never get. And so therefore, I can imagine that transition from employee to consultant feels like a huge one when you don't have that. I was fortunate enough to be what they called a forward deployed engineer at Palantir, where the role was a mixture of engineering and effectively selling. Or, you know, the first job of the role was always to go and find the customer pain point and highlight it in a way that they could understand. And so I was lucky with that experience. But I think most engineers don't have that as a role model or as a path to get there. So when it comes to content creation, then, I mean, you're talking about putting these stories together, putting this in a process. Is that something you look at in terms of, you know, combination of getting your networks, you got people to tell your stories to, and then telling your stories, but from that perspective of what is it for you, the reader, the viewer of this then?
So what I'm going to say straight off the bat, before I go anywhere near content, because I'm always nervous about this. Anybody listening that is thinking about going into any form of consulting-based business or creating a consulting-based business that maybe believes that being a content creator is a route to market, what I would say is it takes time. It took at least 6 months of me consistently, very narrow, talking about my wheelhouse, talking about the thing that I solved in lots of different ways across lots of different formats before people felt confident enough that I was the right person to have conversations with me. So what did I do? The first thing I did was I took my network apart.
networks are a funny thing. They build up over time. You accumulate a whole host of people. The way the algorithms work at the moment in terms of prioritizing who sees your content, if it's going to continue to be a percentage of your followers, then set yourself up for success. Make sure your followers are relevant to your content. And if they're not, it's not a horrid thing to remove them as followers. Just remove. I get heat for it all the time. I remove certain territories. I don't accept connection requests from certain territories where A, currency differential is too great, so I'm never going to sell over there, or B, they don't use that service. So what's the point in that respect? So get your network right and make sure it's a blend. For people say, you know, I can't find my ideal customer. Then find your peer group. Find your peer group because they will refer you. They will whisper where you're relevant and they'll pick people onto you. Build your network rock solid.
Yeah.
And then pick two or three topics. You know, obviously if I was coaching this, there's a very expanded content strategy. But for the purpose of tonight, pick two or three topics that you know inside out and backwards. Solve the problem. Don't gatekeep information. There's no money in it. I'm sorry. If somebody asks you a straight up question at a networking event, you'd answer it. So in your content, pick a problem. Pick the big, scary, painful, horrible problem that you know your ideal customer's got. Solve it. Give them the steps. Teach them, educate them, help them. Do it in lots of different ways. Nurturing ones where you're actually giving the answer. Attraction posts where you're talking about your journey and how you learned that and why it's relevant and why it works. Conversion posts. Yeah, tell people what it is that you do, but do it a little bit. Don't do it a lot. It's too salesy. But do that on repeat. If you're going to use the content approach, do that on repeat across two or three topics. You'll become known for that. And people who are suffering with that problem is the scariest thing. They take that knowledge, and invariably what you've actually done is converted ignorance to informed, still not capable. So I get a lot of people that go, you answered the question, how do I create the perfect ideal customer profile? You told me exactly how to do it and I still can't do it. Can you come and help? What you've actually done is you've positioned yourself higher up their mind in terms of credibility as the right person to talk to. So you don't actually cannibalize your audience and turn them away with freebies. You actually position yourself as valuable.
Yeah. And I think that's one of those things with selling anywhere is the more you can be known for actually bringing solutions and being open with what you know, the more likely somebody is to say to you, well, if you give that away for free, what are you going to do for me when I start paying you? Expecting a lot more. I think the other thing that from my experience as well, you said 6 months there, it took you 6 months to get from the point where you were generating content to actually seeing results from it. I have to say my experience was longer than that. It took more like 9 months to get from the point of view of building a pipeline of content and posting really regularly before I started to get things to come back. And it wasn't because I was doing it badly. It's because there was two missing pieces. And I fixed one of those missing pieces. I thought, now it's going to happen. And I was still waiting for that little gap of, you know, now it's going to happen. And then I fixed the last little piece and suddenly, bang, it started to happen. So yeah, 6 months is, maybe with you helping, it will be 6 months. But I'd say for some other people who are sort of figuring out from playbooks and first steps, it could be longer than that. Mine certainly was.
When I coach new consultants and fractionals in that marketplace, the beginning of the content module always goes the same way. I say, look, I'm going to give you 2 hours worth of knowledge as to how the algorithm works, how content performs, what content is, how to structure a content strategy. But I'm going to preface that with, you are a consultant, not a content creator. Please, please, please do not fall into this trap of the comfort of creating content and speaking to people like that. It's the slowest route to market. So now, you know, the algorithm changes confuse people anyway. But now I look at it and I go, content's purpose, what is it? It's to fill your shop window up with shiny objects that interest people enough to translate into conversation. Nothing more complicated than that. And so if I produce 7 pieces of content a week, it probably takes me 2 hours a week to do. That's where I put content. It's 2 hours of my week. I don't invest any more time in it than that because it doesn't create a high enough return on investment to warrant it.
Right. So that for you then, that the content very much is the means to start the conversations.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the conversations then, because I think that's something that a lot of people have been talking about on the interwebs about how to sell by chat and sell by conversations. But I think it's also one of those areas that a lot of people really struggle with. I mean, you mentioned yourself that thing, if you go to a conference and like, do I really have to speak to these people? Do I have to speak to lots of people? Even more terrifying. So how do you approach making conversational sales something that is easy and doable.
So the same sales coach that helped me out the first time around, I went out to dinner with him to repay the favor, and we were chatting. And he was like, "How do you feel about sales now?" And I was like, "I hate it. Every time I get on a call, every conversation I have, I'm thinking about, am I saying the right thing? Am I doing the right thing? Am I flowing from rapport into discovery into proposal in the right way? Have I set enough time?" And he's like, "Let me just give you one piece of advice. Stop thinking of them as sales calls. Just stop." And so me being me, I'm, you know, ADHD clearly, I went the far end of the spectrum. And I remember sitting down with my wife and saying this and saying, "I'm going to stop selling." And she choked. She didn't see the funny side of that statement. She was like, "How will you make money if you don't sell?" And I was like, "No, you just got to bear with me here. I am a firm believer in reciprocal bias. And there's a healthy amount of it out there." Yeah. And so now when I approach conversations, it doesn't matter whether this is in the real world, whether this is virtually via DMs, whether this is in comment threads on LinkedIn, I do not pitch. And I make light of it in my connection request to people. I go, "Look, if there's one thing I can promise you, I'm not going to pitch," which immediately eradicates the fear in the other person that you're just having a conversation to build up to a pitch slap.
Yeah.
Which we've all seen in DMs, right? Someone viewed your profile, somebody sent you a connection request, somebody complimented you on something funky that you did. "By the way, this is the service I want you to buy." And I go, "Delete." So just talk to people. It sounds horrific as a business model, but it actually does work. I start conversations with people. I go, "Hey, you know, I see you're in this line of work. Is this the sort of challenge that you're facing right now? How's things in your world?" You know, it's 1,000 different ways of just asking a conversation starting question. And then listen. And if you can help, just help. And do that. Some of those client conversations, they become clients, certainly in the coaching landscape, they become clients in a matter of hours.
Yeah.
Some of them might take months. From my perspective, the investment in time is building a pipeline of people that go, "You know, I had a chat with Dan and it was really bloody useful and I've got a ton of things to do and I'd love to work with him." And they come back. They come back regular as clockwork and they say, "Okay, you win. Pitch." And that's the best moment in those conversations when somebody comes to you and says, "How do I work with you? What does that look like? What do you even do?"
Yeah.
Or, "I've read somewhere that you've got this coaching program. How do I get involved?" Or even back in my CTO days, I'd have CEOs that come to me and say, "So-and-so said that you do this. What does that look like?" And I'm like, "Wow, it's a reverse pitch." So yeah, I think selling in DMs or selling in conversation is a strange phrase. I genuinely just look at it as talk to a ton of people. And even in my coaching side, we have a sort of Monday morning accountability group. I don't track impressions, don't track follower growth and network growth and downloads of lead magnets, etc., etc. I track the number of new conversations that I'm starting each week,
right?
And I scale that based on how many clients I need at the far end of the process. If I've got no clients, then I want to be doing 30 conversations a week, every single week. If I've got 5 clients, I want to do 1 conversation because I really don't need any more. And I work with people on that basis. I go, "Look, how many people did you speak to last week?" Well, they say to me, 2. "So you're not hungry then?" Because if I was hungry, I'd talk to as many people as I could.
Yeah, and 6 or 7 a day.
Those people that follow that advice suddenly come back to me and go, "Oh my God, my diary's full. I don't know what to do now. I've got so many people I'm talking to and some of them are at different stages and some are converting into discoveries and some are converting into retained services. And if only I'd known it was that easy." Like, that's because you spent too long watching The Wolf of Wall Street and not enough time actually thinking about humans.
This is it. I've had people who sort of talk to me and they say, "Oh, I sort of lose track of where people are at and have to go rescan the whole conversation to work out whether I should be, you know, selling or pitching or converting." And I think for me, that was one of those moments where just say the next thing in the conversation. Then you can have lots of conversations running in parallel because you're just going to say the next thing. The idea is to help and get them to reply to the next next thing that you say, rather than, you know, complete some step and cross a milestone of achievement in a pipeline somewhere. And it helps keep the conversations more genuine, I find, as well. I mean, it's something, as you say, somebody can sniff out a pitch slap. I love that expression. You know, when somebody does face you with one of those things, you can kind of see it straight away and you think, no, don't like that. But yet, if somebody's just talking to you, it feels natural and it feels straightforward. And you know, talking about making this whole process scale up, how big do you need to scale it up? Because I think I hear different things from some people saying, oh, I need to have this massive pipeline to keep me going. And you've mentioned sort of 30 conversations a week is enough to fill your pipeline from almost empty. Is it as simple as that? Just figure out how much you need and then work backwards in terms of your success rate in closing, and then I'll start learning conversations.
I'd love to make this more scientific and complicated than it really needs to be, but I'm a bloke. Okay, so I'm going to say it exactly as I see it. This number will change based on how good you get at doing it. And to your point, nobody likes to feel like they're in a process. So my rule is, until somebody books a meeting with me, they're not in a process. Once they've booked a meeting, if we go through that standard understanding need, sending out an offer, then they are in a process that I will follow up, because it keeps it predictable for both of us.
Yeah.
But before that, there's no process. Before that, I'm just talking to people. And it drives my wife insane. She's like, you just spend all day talking to people and then we make money. How was that a business? So I think in terms of understanding the answer, you have to have had a moderate level of experience that said, I need this many clients. And in order to get that, I'm going to work the conversion rate from client to offer, offer to conversation, or conversation to meeting, meeting to offer, offer to client, whichever way you want to go. I'm going to work the conversion rates. And then I'm going to work back. And that's my big number. And then I'm going to divide that number up over a number of weeks, because I couldn't do it in a week. But in my experience, let's be straight up here. Most retained roles that I see right the way across the C-suite sit at somewhere between 6 and 15K a month. If I take like a totally uncapped retained service, you know, you can talk to me as much as you want throughout the month. I'm going to provide you advisory. I'm going to stop you making mistakes. I'm going to keep you facing forward. I'm going to charge you $8,000 a month for that. How many of those do you need? How much are you trying to make, for crying out loud? Most people I know want to make somewhere between 350 and 500 a year. Divide it back. Do the maths. The sweet spot for most consultants that are working that, and they're also doing diagnostic stuff at the bottom, and they're also doing maybe some statements of work, you know, discrete deliverables, 4 clients. Much beyond 4. And what I find is that the thing that got you there suffers. You don't do the business development. And then you come back to me in a year's time and go, I've just had 3 clients that have signed off all in one go because market conditions changed or my competition took them away from me. Now what do I do? And I go, something you should have done 8 months ago, which is not stop building your relationships.
So that's a sort of continuous sales process to make sure that you've got constant deal flow.
Just keep talking to people. Go to events. Go and actually be genuinely interested in people and follow up with them. And, you know, I have some people that I look at and go, you're not my client today and you probably won't be in 6 months, but I'm not going to lose touch with you. I will look at the value that is there and I will set a cadence and I will make contact with you every month or every 2 months or every 3 months just to make sure that we're continuing, we're perpetuating. Some of those things turn into clients. Some of them turn into podcasts, Adam, let's be honest. But it's true. You know, we'd had a little bit of a chat. We'd made contact a few times. We'd supported each other's content. It seemed like the natural thing to do was the next stage was a collaboration. And so I look at it and go, if you stop doing that, what you're saying is, I don't need to go and find clients ever. It's never the case. Sooner or later, the client leaves, client goes into attrition, client goes bankrupt, client runs out of money, client hires a permanent equivalent of you. There are always going to be opportunities for them to move on. You're much better having a pipeline of opportunities that you can talk to. If you get to a point where you've got too many, then farm them out. Go and join a fractional group and talk to people and see if anybody else wants to take over the reins on a given opportunity and see if they want to move it forward and help them as well. Rather than just all this little siloed mentality.
Yeah. And often when you're working with multiple people, I mean, you talked about before, you want to be able to enjoy what you're doing and love it. And if you've got a choice of who you work with, then you can pick the ones to work with that actually really fulfill you and are fun and enjoyable to work with. Not to say that those people are everybody else's cup of tea, but they're the best ones for you. And you don't have that optionality if you don't have a full pipeline of possibilities.
Nope.
You're I also thought about it from the other point of view as well. Yeah. Yeah, I always think about it from another point of view as well, which is that, you know, if you've got plenty of people that you could possibly work with and you're putting time and effort constantly into this marketing, sales, positioning, whatever you want to call it, it's a bit like as a consultant, you're a scaled down version of any other company. How many companies don't have a marketing department? How many companies don't have a salesman? Very few, right? So you kind of have to be those things. You have to put a proportion of your time into it. Otherwise, you're not a credible company. So look at it from that perspective.
It's a really valid perspective. And if you watch closely in a lot of my content, I call it out. Go solopreneur. What does it really mean? It means you have to be really good at something that you can sell, but you also have to be your own chief marketing officer, your own chief revenue officer, your own CFO. There isn't an aspect of business that you don't have to be kind of good at or learn enough about, or you're going to end up outsourcing it and paying for it. So for me, those that neglect that side of their business, so you're not serious about your business being around in 5 years, 10 years, 15 years time. And it was that mentality I rode through COVID, where all of my colleagues, my friends were coming to me saying, we've been furloughed, we've been laid off. I went into COVID with 5 clients. I came out of COVID with 3 that still covered all of my bases because I built them up and I got them to that point where I could afford a loss without going bankrupt in the process or panicking.
Yeah.
So it's a sensible investment.
As a real testament to the process then.
Yeah.
That on its own, I think.
I'm not going to lie, I was nervous.
I think everybody was, right?
I became perpetually quite anxious about the situation, but I doubled down. You know, I doubled down on client relationship, on making sure that I was doing the right things for them and that they were seeing value throughout that period. I doubled down on the networking that I was allowed to do. So I continued, I had more free time, I could go and do it. I got furloughed by 2 of my clients, so I had more time to go and build that. So I just threw my energy into that. And let's be honest, it was that or doing home education with my kids. So I chose the route of least resistance, which was generate revenue for the house rather than that side of thing. And we got through it. And I think that's, to your point, that's testament to having a process that works.
And then, of course, you get to literally enjoy your life. So now you're at the point where you're doing your Western horse riding. You've got those amazing guitars on the wall behind you, which are obviously a big passion of yours.
Yep. Essentially, when I started this journey, I didn't know what good looked like. I got divorced, found somebody else, settled down, had 2 children. She already had 3 children, so we've got 5 children in the house. And then I woke up like, age 41, and she was equestrian, and I said, I want to do horses, but I want to do it Western. And she was like, I can't help you, I've got no idea what that is. You've picked the one aspect of equestrian life that I couldn't understand. And so I got into it. I threw myself into it headlong. I joined the Western Equestrian Society, became their secretary, started going to shows and events and clinics and camps and all of the things. If I look at my life now, 10 years later, there are various points in the year where I pack up a 7.5-ton horse box with horses, Starling, laptops, kids, everything that I need. And I disappear to the other end of the country for 4 days, 5 days, where in the gaps, I'm riding horses, I'm competing, I'm training. And then in between that, I'm coaching people on headsets, quite often sat in the middle of a field. It just blends together. And to your point, that's the life that you create for yourself and it enables you to enjoy it. And if I look back at the last 5 years of my life, I genuinely have no complaints. No, it has not been easy. Let's just clear that myth.
Yeah.
Not a walk in the park. But if you want that dream life, it doesn't matter whether it's horses or whether it's travel or whether it's, you know, something else, that's what you want. Then do yourself a favor and actually chase it and go and do it. Put in the hours, put in the legwork, put in the effort to get yourself there. Because when you look backwards, you go, God, it's the only thing I ever regret. Didn't do it sooner. The only regret.
That's a wonderful story. And I do love the analogy of chase what you want, don't chase ambulances. It's a good comparison.
Don't chase ambulances. They're all headed in the same direction. You don't want to go there. So don't chase ambulances. chase healthy people instead. It's an old sales analogy about people that chase deals to death. And they said, don't chase the ambulances because they're all headed towards the hospital. Right. Makes perfect sense to me now you say it like that.
Definitely. Cool. Dan, it's been a wonderful chat. We've covered all sorts of topics, but let me try and boil down your sort of key tips into the areas that we discussed and see if I get it right. So if I miss anything out, just fill me in. So we spoke at the beginning about, you know, figuring out what it is you do and make sure it's tight enough that it can be called a niche. And you didn't like the expression, but ICP, it's the marketing term. It's the people that you actually do your work for, your ideal customer profile. Get that right. That was step one. Step two, closely related to that, profile. So that's LinkedIn profile and the brand. So what is it you stand for? What is it you're going to do? How are you going to help people? Yeah. And then the other thing we had was be very clear on what you're selling and how you sell it. What are your products? What are your services? And how do people buy it from you? Mm-hmm. So then our next section, being seen in general, you spoke about three things there as well. So one was that we spent a lot of time talking about content creation, what it is and how important it is. We spoke about building the network, talking to people, starting conversations, and going on from that, selling through the conversations themselves and talking to people.
Talk to people.
Just talk to people. And then right at the very end, then are the last three steps. I love these ones. So first of all, the business development, how you actually turn that into a process. And you said you reduced it down to about 2 hours per week with a post per day.
Yep. My content creation takes place at 6 a.m. on a Saturday morning before my kids come out of bed and before I go in and enjoy my weekend. And I can create 7 pieces of content, including imagery, in about 2 hours. And what that does, it frees up time in my working day to have conversations. I'm not panicking about what post I put out tomorrow because it's already scheduled. It's there. So tomorrow morning when I get out of bed and I bounce down into my office, I will go through a list of maybe 10 to 15 people that I want to talk to today, and I'll send them a message. I'll wake up the conversation. I'll continue the conversation from the day before. I don't have to think about content too much.
Because it's already done and scheduled. So turning that into a process and making it systematic and then scaling it up. But we talked about there, understanding the target of what you want to build and then working backwards from there to the scale that you need, rather than sort of just scaling it for scale's sake.
Too many people chase ridiculous numbers without any recognition that maybe achieving the number will break something somewhere else. That was my lesson from my corporate life, is to achieve this, I had to sell all of this. You know, my soul, my sanity, my passion, I got rid of because I was focused on this. When I started the consulting business, I knew what number I needed, you know, to make a stable business that paid my bills and paid for my lifestyle. I put about 25% on top of that as sort of like, this is good upside. When I hit it, not that you stop trying, you stop chasing as hard, you stop pushing as hard, and you go and enjoy. You know, I don't panic now. If I have 2 days in a week where I'm not massively busy, I simply pack my laptop up and disappear off out and go and do something that I want to do with my time instead. Because that's what you were trying to create, right? Is flexibility, a life. I hate it when I see people that are just like, well, I was chained to my desk from 9 till 5 for 6 days a week and I still didn't achieve an outcome. Then you did something very, very wrong.
So it's all about getting to that work-life blend that we spoke about at the beginning.
Yeah, totally. Totally, totally.
Brilliant. Dan, it's been amazing to talk to you. How do people get hold of you and how can people ask you for help?
Simple. Coming up a chat. I'm on LinkedIn. My profile's open. Send me a message. Send me a connection request. What I do offer people is if people are serious and they want to get into consulting or they want to find out more about what I do and how I help, obviously I do have a program, I offer a 30-minute consultation. What we'll do in that time frame is we will talk about where you are at right now and what good looks like for you. And then I will show you exactly how I help. If anybody's of interest, I know Adam, I've given you the links. I'm sure you'll put them out with the podcast. So they're
available. We can put them on the podcast, yeah.
And that's it. I'm not pushing a landing page or a course start or anything. Let's just have some conversations. And
we'll have a chat.
I'm going to have a chat.
Wonderful and straightforward. Dan, it's been wonderful speaking to you. Thanks very much.
And yourself. Always a pleasure, sir.
And for those listening, keep leading with impact. Thanks so much. Thank you very much for listening all the way through to the end. Just before you go, I'd like to ask you for one thing in return for putting together all these episodes of the CTO Playbook podcast for you. Please leave a review. Wherever you're listening, whether that is Apple Podcasts or Spotify or whichever platform you're on, leaving a quick review will help more CTOs find the podcast and enable me to create more great episodes. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you on the next episode of the CTO Playbook.